Good afternoon. This is a special edition of At Issue here on WGXE. At Issue normally airs on the first and third Wednesdays of each month, and we are airing a special episode of the show. We recorded the interview that we'll be playing toward the for the rest of the show with Zephyr Teachout. Zephyr Teachout is a Democratic candidate for governor. And she made an appearance here in the city of Hudson on Sunday. I'm with my co-host, Deborah Gilbert.
Hello.
And we're going to do a little bit of a setup and explain a little bit about what's been going on with this campaign. And then we'll play the full interview, which is about 40 minutes with that we recorded Sunday morning here at the station right before her appearance at Basilica Hudson. So a lot has happened in the day that that she's been here. We're recording this segment on Monday afternoon, and there was a court case that Governor Cuomo's campaign brought to try to knock her off the ballot. There is a requirement in this state that anyone running for the seat of governor has to have lived in the state for 5 years, and the governor's campaign was claiming that she was not a continuous resident of the state of New York for all of that time, and she has prevailed in that case and has won, and will be on the ballot. So that's a big victory for her.
Now it seems like this is a challenge to the governor that came up all of a sudden out of nowhere. I've only known about Teachout's candidacy for a month or two.
Yeah, well, it was a very quick thing, but it has been leading up to it, and she had attempted to take the Working Families Party line, and from what I understand, got like I think 46% of the vote. The governor made a number of promises to the Working Families Party to fight for an increase in the minimum wage and campaign finance reform, the Women's Equality Act, and to work for a Democratic state Senate, which as some of you know may he has not necessarily worked for in the past to have a majority, a Democratic majority in the state Senate. In fact, had endorsed a number of Republicans in the previous election, mainly Republicans that had supported same-sex marriage in New York State. So unfortunately, I think three out of the four of those Republicans lost their seats. So over that issue, as people know, most people know I'm the chairman of the Hudson Democrats, I would have preferred to see the Democrats win those seats, but certainly it's disheartening that Republicans who stood up on the right side and voted for marriage equality were defeated over that issue, just like they were in this district here,
and just like Stephen Soland was defeated over that very issue.
Right.
A couple of years ago. Teachout's sudden candidacy does show what one small person can do in terms of shifting a very powerful governor slightly to the left.
Yeah. I think that certainly her her challenge of him for the Working Families Party, and then once she did not receive that, she pulled together 45,000 signatures. She needed 15,000 signatures to get on the Democratic ballot, and in only a week, because you went between the defeat at the Working Families Party and then the deadline for filing petitions to get on the Democratic line was a week later. So they managed to pull together what is almost a near impossibility for an unknown candidate. Clearly, she has a lot of support, because people went out and carried these petitions and got 45,000 people to sign their petitions.
Must have been a real busy week.
Right. I think a lot of the people who were supporting her for the Working Families Party line jumped to it and went and helped organize the petitioning for her on the Democratic line. So it's but it's no small feat for anybody who has worked on petitioning and try to get somebody on the ballot. It's not an easy task. You have to get it right. They have to be the petitions have to be drawn up properly. There's always technicalities.
If an address is wrong, the name gets thrown out. Right. That's my understanding.
Yeah, I mean it can be, not necessarily. There's it's up to the challenger to challenge the petitions and to say why they're challenging them. In this case, the governor did not challenge the petitions at all. He challenged her on her residency rather than challenge the validity of the petitions, which speak well to them pulling it together so quickly. So, Deborah, you were there at Basilica, and it was really impressive. I mean, more than 100 people were present.
Yeah,
and I think she was extremely well received. What were your perceptions of the?
She's
show?
A remarkable speaker. You know, we interviewed her right before her Basilica appearance, and that will be run after we finish talking now. But when she was on the stage at Basilica, not really a stage, but the floor, she really had us, you know, listening to every mm-hmm. word she had to say, and her sense of humor is marvelous. Right. I was really struck by her. Mm-hmm. I'm going to vote for her. Mm-hmm. I think she's a real bright star on our, mm-hmm. you know, pretty lackluster political horizon.
Right. I thought she was really funny, too. I think she was delightful. Yeah, I think it was really great.
And she made fun of her name, Zephyr.
She said,
Zephyr, teach out.
She said her parents are letting her say that her parents were hippies, although they weren't.
And then you told me later that her middle name is Rain.
Right. Zephyr. Sounds like hippies to me. I don't know.
Rain, teach out. I had wondered if her last name was French, but she says it's Dutch.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, what were your thoughts about just the issues that she was covering? Because I think it's... I think it's a pretty wide-ranging agenda. Mm-hmm. She really seemed to cover most of it. What did you think about it?
Well, I thought her financial plan was a good one, and a working wage is a good living wage is so important. You know, I heard about the housing shortage here and affordable housing and. She didn't address that, but the working wage is key mm-hmm. to bringing up the lower sector of the economy and helping kind of energize our whole economy.
Right.
And, you know, I really respect her for being on that bandwagon.
I think when people, what I think gets lost in the discussion about minimum wage is that when people are fighting just to pay their rent or their mortgage or their utilities and put food on the table, there really is no additional spending, and it's really, you know, these low cost, low wage jobs that people are in is really holding back the economy, because obviously when there's money in people's pocket, they spend it and the economy does better. And yet when you have big corporations like Walmart and other low wage jobs, those people are not really adding to the economy, because they're just it's hand to mouth and literally.
Yeah. We're living in a society now where kids who get out of college can't find a cheap apartment, mm-hmm. can't find a job.
Right.
They're back at home with mom and dad. They can't start families. They can't go out and, you know, buy things mm-hmm. and support the economy, you know, because
right.
shopping's an important part of the economy. The economy can't grow mm-hmm. with these few resources.
Right. I think one of the remarkable things is how she has really put this campaign together with virtually no money, but is really starting to get traction. And I think one of the big issues here is what the situation will be with the governor by the time that the primary rolls around, because the primary is almost exactly a month from today, a month from now. It's September 9th. But yet this Moreland Commission problem and the investigation by Preet Bharara, who's the federal prosecutor in New York, it seems as if anything can happen. When we look at what happened with Governor Spitzer, you know, one day he was on top of the world, and the next, and you know, a week and a half later, he was out. And
history.
And it's you know, when you look at the history that's already there, and you realize that anything could happen between now and then, you know, she may well be the candidate. And
yeah, well, one thing that's very important is her stand on anti-corruption. Mm-hmm. And Cuomo has been, the governor has been a big disappointment in the sort of moral, ethical, you know, corruption area. Mm-hmm. He said he was going to change things in Albany, and it's just been more of the same. She stands for, you know, campaign financing. And one point she made was women and minorities just don't run as much if they have to raise their own money, because it's all the good old boys club. And I think that was a really good point. And I think, you know, she is a woman. She's a really sound candidate, because she's an attorney. She's been on the Sunshine Foundation. That was a new one to me. I'm going to have to look that up. But that's an anti-corruption and bring more daylight into government. Those are all things I think we need a lot more of in Albany.
There's an article in yesterday's Politico as well, politico.com, on the governor, and what they're saying is that the Cuomo's in more trouble than is even being put out there, and that federal prosecutors in general do not get into these types of conversations about targets of their investigation unless A, there is serious charges behind it, and B, that they will win those cases. So it's for the Barrera to have been as vocal as he has been about indicating that there are serious problems with you know, witness tampering and other serious potential crimes involved with his top staff and with Cuomo's big contributors, and that's the charge, is that when the Moreland Commission started preparing subpoenas that were aimed at big contributors of the governor, that his top aide interceded on behalf of those things and tried to quash those subpoenas, and then the governor, you know, decommissioned the commission. So it's you know, the potential problems for the governor are substantial. So it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out in the next 4 weeks. Right now he's clammed up and is not speaking about it. And I think you'll hear some of that in the interview that we're about to play. I guess time will tell.
Yeah, over and over, Teachout said during her appearance at Basilica, he just hasn't really been there. You know, he put out a moratorium on fracking, but he hasn't really spoken out against it because some of his big donors are frackers.
Right, exactly. So I think we're going to wrap up our conversation here, and then you will be hearing an interview with Zephyr Teachout, the Democratic candidate for governor, who has now just won the case brought by the governor's campaign to try to throw her off the ballot. She will indeed be a candidate on the September 9th primary against Governor Cuomo. There's another candidate on the ballot as well, who is a comedian and has ran for mayor mayor of New York City in the last election, and his name escapes me at the moment. But seems like the race is between the two of them.
But this is an unusual thing, I understand, because sitting governors don't usually get challenged in their party's primary.
Yes, exactly.
So it's kind of irritating to the governor.
A primary in this case is a big deal, and so
this could be a good opportunity for people to voice their dissatisfaction with the governor's performance. Mm-hmm. Maybe so, even make a change.
Yeah. So you will hear this interview, and I'll remind you that this is a special edition of At Issue on WGXE 90.7 FM. This interview is with Zephyr Teachout, the Democratic candidate for governor. Hello, this is At Issue on WGXE 90.7 FM. I'm Victor Mandolia.
I'm Deborah Gilbert.
And we are very proud and happy to have Zephyr Teachout here, who is running for the Democratic in the Democratic primary for governor. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here on this beautiful, beautiful Sunday.
So tell us a little bit about how your campaign is going. You are a dark horse, I would say, right? How is it going?
I am an underdog, but you know New York loves underdogs. Mm-hmm. And the last 2 weeks, we really caught fire. A lot of that's due to what Governor Andrew Cuomo has been doing and not doing.
Right.
It's now been 2.5 weeks since the New York Times came out with a real major and very scorching story about Cuomo's top aides' interference in Andrew Cuomo's anti-corruption commission,
right,
and its own investigations. But, you know, the story itself was quite devastating. And then Andrew Cuomo's response to it has been nothing short of bizarre.
Right.
He was first really silent, refusing to talk about it. And then he spoke about it for a few days. Another top aide started calling members of this anti-corruption Moreland commission and telling them the kind of things they were hoping they'd say to the press. Mm-hmm. The federal prosecutor said, wait a second, that looks a little bit like witness tampering. And now Andrew Cuomo has again sort of really gone silent, saying, I'm not going to talk about it. And I will tell you, you know, people are going to be pretty generous towards their governor. They're willing to hear different explanations. But the one thing they're not willing to hear is no explanation.
Mm-hmm. So there's been sort of this cloud in a way about his secrecy and about his handling of strong arm tactics with employees or with state employees or staff and that kind of thing. Maybe you could speak a little bit to that. What do you think about that?
Yeah, well, you know, actually, you know, just to step back a little bit, you know, I am running in the Democratic primary against him, and just to be clear, I supported him 4 years ago.
Right.
I think a lot of people in my position did. They saw somebody who, you know, I really had admired Mario Cuomo, and Andrew Cuomo said, "Hey, I'm going to come in. I'm going to clean up Albany. Mm-hmm. I see a swamp of corruption. I'm going to deal with the money and politics problem, and I'm going to bust up this secret culture here." And instead, over the last 4 years, what Albany insiders have seen is that he's become master of this machine, this mm-hmm. this culture of corruption that he once said he would fix. And then I guess more New Yorkers have learned about that in the last couple of weeks. But the basic idea is that he's a master of the secret backroom negotiation. Mm-hmm. So maybe a lot of voters don't see it, but the governor of New York has more budgetary power and appointment power and control over commissions than any governor in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And that means if somebody stands up against him, he can threaten to take away their funding.
Right.
And unfortunately, he has a reputation for making that kind of threat,
right,
saying, you know, it's my way or the highway. And if you don't support me X, Y, or way politically, your constituency is going to be hurt. And that's no way to govern, mm-hmm. because that means he's putting his own political interests or maybe the interests of his donors ahead
right.
of the interests of the people of New York.
And some people think that the Moreland Commission was nothing more than a strong arm tactic for the legislature to get a few things done that he wanted to do. Is that something that you believe as well?
Yeah, but it got out of his control.
Oh, right.
I mean, so he set it up because there was extraordinary grassroots pressure to actually change the way campaigns are funded. And that's something I've been a part of for a long time. I've
right.
been activist on public funding of elections for a decade now. I think it's essential. We need to change the way that
right.
We need to change basically who our politicians serve.
Mm-hmm.
That's what that's about. And he got a lot of pressure to do that. But instead of passing that, he thought he could get away with setting up this commission. And the commission would then be used perhaps as a pawn. But he made a mistake, because once he set up the commission, in order to do that, he actually had to deputize attorneys general.
Right.
The executive order that created the commission didn't just create commissioners. It created deputy attorneys general with the power to investigate what was going on in the legislature. And as Andrew Cuomo promised, the power to investigate him.
Right.
He said this commission can go anywhere. It can look at anything.
Including me.
Including me. And he said, you know, and it's something that is so powerful to remember now. He said, New Yorkers can sleep better at night because we're going to get to the root of corruption.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't get to deputize attorney generals and then tell them what to do.
Mm-hmm.
They say power corrupts. Do you think that's what's happened to the governor?
Well, I will say he's been in power for a long time, and he grew up in power. And, you know, as I said, I really admired his father. But perhaps, you know, by being the son of a governor, he never got used to the idea that all laws apply to everybody equally.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what the real moral offense in his actions or his top aide's action in the Moreland Commission is there's strong evidence that his top aide shielded his donors and business associates from the law. Now, the idea that there's one set of laws for everybody, but then you don't have to follow those laws if you're the friend of a governor is a pretty basic misunderstanding of the idea of law itself.
Mm-hmm. So let's take a step back because some people are only just hearing about you for the first time. Could you tell us a little bit about your background and what brought you to this point where you are running for governor in the state?
Sure. I currently am a law professor at Fordham Law School, and I've been teaching there for 5 years. My background is largely in politics, political organizing, and my focus has been money and politics, sort of taking on the way money affects politics, and then also taking on the role of concentrated private power, what we used to call monopolies, or looking at antitrust.
Mm-hmm.
So I founded a nonprofit dedicated to breaking up big banks.
Right.
The simplest way to put it,
mm-hmm.
Where we would lobbied heavily on the Hill on making sure that we rein in the power of J.P. Morgan and Bank of America. I was the national I was the national director of the Sunlight Foundation, which is one of the arguably the largest anti-corruption organization in the country. And then I love politics. Mm-hmm. I just love talking to people. I love listening to people. And I've worked on political campaigns up and down the line. I've worked on presidential campaigns, congressional mm-hmm. campaigns, Senate campaigns.
Right. So we're recording this about an hour before you're going to speak to people here in Hudson. How is the campaign going? How do you think that things are happening for you? I mean, certainly all this publicity that the governor would think would be, you know, was working toward for him, I mean, seems to be working for you because there's been story after story after story about him trying to knock you off the ballot. So how is the campaign going for you?
Well, look, I mean, as we sort of jokingly referred to in the beginning, but it's quite true is, I started off completely unknown as a true underdog. And the last 2 weeks, we've gotten a lot more attention as Democrats have looked around and say, we need an alternative.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are a lot of, but to be fair, there were a lot of Democrats who were already looking.
Right.
Because if you care about fracking, the governor has been entirely silent on fracking, mm-hmm. despite, you know, overwhelming evidence that it's dangerous.
Right.
Or if you care about public education, if you're a parent or a teacher, I've had support from parents and teachers from the very beginning mm-hmm. who felt it was mandatory that this governor have a primary opponent.
Right.
These have been terrible times for public education.
Yeah, no, I've been talking to teachers who teaching classes of 32 kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't teach in that environment. Every kid deserves to be paid attention to.
Mm-hmm.
How did you come to run? Did people come to you or did you step forward?
People came to me in March. And they initially approached me. There's a long laundry list of Democratic betrayals of Governor Andrew Cuomo. Mm-hmm. I really see him as governing as a crony capitalist Republican mm-hmm. and not as a Democrat.
Right. So, many people in this district have a real problem with him because in the last election, Roy McDonald had been primaried from the right against, you know, mainly over the gay marriage issue. Then when he lost the primary, we had, Robin Andrews, who is a, you know, openly gay supervisor here in Columbia, or was an openly gay supervisor in Claverick, and the governor refused to support her in the general election, and you know, this was after much pleading and trying to get him to get involved in the race because a lot of the money that had gone to McDonald, people were really not going to spend more money on that race unless it looked like there was a shot, and he really needed to step forward and didn't. It was really a shame, I thought.
Well, it's part of a pattern. It's part of a pattern of not stepping forward in any situation he does not absolutely have
mm-hmm,
to.
Mm-hmm.
There's a real ethics problem at the local level. There's something called New York State Ethics Law, I guess Statute 800, municipal law. And what's happened in our county is people are able to use ethics complaints to drive others out of office and to smear their reputations.
Which happened to our friend Deborah here.
It happened to me, yeah.
Okay. Well, tell me more about what happened.
Well, I was elected to the town board. Once I was elected, it was the first time in 30 years that Democrats had a majority. And I was probably the most vocal opponent of the Republican former status quo. And they were kind of still in charge because the town clerk acted as a sort of extra board member and did what she could to hide information from us about corrupt practices in the past. And even our town insurance agent, who was and remains the county head of the county Republican Party, had withheld town funds through kind of a crooked thing
and
state auditors discovered but really did nothing about.
And they used an ethics complaint to really smear and drive her out of office.
Yeah, I mean, what's so unfortunate is here we have this first-rate state with the most talented people in the world, I'd say, with these extraordinary resources, with the best writers, chefs, farmers, business owners, and we have this totally third-rate old boy, corrupt crony politics.
And it is an amazing disconnect.
There's a real disconnect, and unfortunately, a lot of people then drop out of politics altogether,
right?
Because they see it as a swamp and a swamp they don't want to be a part of. But it really, this kind of corruption, then really affects people's lives.
Yep.
Because it helps explain why in this. I mean, we have a Democratic state. This is not a state where there's any question about where people are. 60% of the state is Democratic. Mm-hmm. People in the state believe in progressive taxation.
Right.
They believe in public education. They believe in actually investing in infrastructure, like really building roads and bridges. And
we are called the Empire State after all.
Yes,
right?
Exactly. So
maybe they once believed in that.
Well, I
think the people do. I mean, and people want to be connected. I think about this as sort of a state that is so and also deeply, deeply open to immigrants. You know, really, we don't have the Statue of Liberty for nothing. Mm-hmm. And yet our politics are, we have basically a Republican governor and Republican policies and deeply secretive and deeply disconnected. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a few different ways that I understand that. One is this governor, who I think many, many people feel betrayed by, because what he described is what I'm describing. He said, our basic problem is a problem of corruption. I'm going to go clean that up. And he really failed to do that. But the other is a systemic problem. I mean, he represents something that's happening in the country where more and more Democrats are really abandoning these very traditional Democratic values. And I'm a down-the-line, traditional populist progressive Democrat, which is where most New Yorkers are. They're really abandoning that because they're starting to serve big donors.
Right.
And it's happening quite rapidly, and it's affecting our education system. It's affecting our tax policy, which is upside down in this state. The richest New Yorkers pay less than the middle 20%.
So maybe you could go through a little bit, like, just why don't we hit a couple of topics, the things that you say, this is where I stand and this is where he stands and I think that he's wrong on those issues. That I think that would be helpful for people.
Great. Well, I think we should ban fracking. I'm extremely proud and impressed with the work of, you know, what call them the fractivists of New York, because there's been this wave of state after state that has given in to hundreds of millions, billions of dollars in campaign funding, and have led to hydrofracking. And the evidence is now in. It's extremely dangerous to the water supply. It leads to earthquakes.
Right.
We still don't know what those chemicals are that they're using.
And it's shrouded in a lot of secrecy. And Governor Andrew Cuomo has refused to answer fundamental questions about where he stands on hydrofracking, even though he's taken over $1 million in pro-fracking money for his campaigns. So I think this state is at this real crossroads, and we need to move towards renewables. That's very, very, very mm-hmm. clear. But there needs to be a real stability and understanding in that. Farmers need to know that their land and their water isn't going to get poisoned by hydrofracking, so mm-hmm. that if they want to turn to a solar farm or they want to develop, move into a new kind of agriculture, they can be confident that it's not threatened with hydrofracking. So it's leading to some instability in the economy of our state that Governor Cuomo hasn't answered the question on hydrofracking. And I'm very concerned that if he's reelected, he would do something which would be classic Andrew Cuomo, which is to say, hey, we'll keep the moratorium because we have a moratorium, but I will also do a demonstration project in hydrofracking.
Right.
So well, it's Orwellian language. Where yeah.
So he's trying to have it both ways,
yeah.
you're saying.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of people,
a failure of leadership.
A lot of people believe that it'll be in the southern tier, yes. that they'll yeah. allow it in the southern tier and, yeah. and keep the moratorium elsewhere. Which it,
yeah. So I've been very, I've been talking to people at the Solutions Project looking at, there are plans in this state where we could really be moving forward with more investments in solar farms and offshore wind to move towards a truly renewable future and be a real model for the country.
Right.
Another area that we deeply, deeply and openly differ is on education. He started his governorship by proposing one of the largest cuts to education funding in state history in order to pay for tax breaks for big banks and millionaires. And the impacts of that have been nothing short of devastating in the schools. Hundreds of teachers in every district that I've talked to are losing their jobs. You might have one art teacher for 1,200 kids who's cycling through each kid as if he and she are little widgets instead of children mm-hmm. who need art and music and phys ed in order to become full adults. The suspension rate in this state is quite high, and that suspension leads to a school-to-prison pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
Part of that is that there's draconian rules in the schools, but part of that is that these classes are so overcrowded and there aren't the counselors that kids need and the support system that you need in the schools to enable those kids to figure out how they can really get something out of school and stay in school instead mm-hmm. of leaving. We also disagree on Common Core and high-stakes testing in general. Effectively, Andrew Cuomo has represented an ideology that says you can replace funding with testing. And we know that's not true.
Right.
So that's a big area of disagreement. And I've gotten a lot of support from parents who've seen how the high-stakes testing and the overcrowded classes are really, really affecting their kids, and they know we are going in the wrong direction in education.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean when you say high stakes testing? Because I know Race to the Top, the president's educational program, takes as a model the Harlem Children's Zones, and Jeffrey Canada believes in testing to see how kids are doing. Is that not high stakes testing?
Well, the kind of thing that I'm most concerned about is testing. Although I think there's challenges with testing across the board, although we need to have some testing, is the testing that evaluates and then rewards or punishes teachers,
okay,
depending on how the children in their classroom do. I was myself a special ed teacher's aide in a small rural public school, and now I teach at law school, so it's of course a different category, but it's still teaching. And I'll tell you that anybody will tell you that kids do not learn well or thrive in high stress environments, and there is nothing that assures a high stress environment more than making the children's scores responsible for the teacher's pay.
Sure.
So that's my deepest concern. Now I think there's a great possibility in teachers and parents and community members coming together to develop standards and tests, but not in a way where we're teaching towards the test, but tests where we have a shared set of standards that we are all trying to move towards. I think that's very valuable. But we need to match that along with resources and not do this in a resource-free way.
Have you taken a stand on marijuana or the legalization of marijuana?
I have, yes. I think we need to move towards decriminalization and then legalization.
Mm-hmm.
And by move towards, very quickly.
Right.
Right now there are the arrests, marijuana arrests, are disproportionately of
people of color,
of kids of color,
right?
Who do not belong in jail or prison. But then also, it's cruel and callous to those who want to use it for medical reasons. That although Governor Cuomo passed a very, very narrow medical marijuana law, it only covers those who
with very specific illnesses, which may not necessarily be. There are other illnesses that may or may not be helped by marijuana, but certainly doctors and their patients should be able to make those choices themselves.
It's specific illnesses, and it's specific kinds of equipment that you can use, and it's expensive equipment, which you should be able to get covered.
Right.
But basically, there's a class component to this, too.
Right.
You know, that if somebody is smoking under the medical marijuana law as Governor Andrew Cuomo pushed through, smoking marijuana, even for medical reasons, is still criminal.
Right.
And, you know, I think we've all had friends who've suffered from serious illnesses where it was a very powerful and meaningful source of relief.
Right, right.
The New York Times had an article by Gina Belafonte, which I thought was terrific. And in it, she says... you've proposed a fiscal policy that, quote, would alleviate the austerity that Mr. Cuomo's coddling of the summer house and seaplane demographic has begotten. Is that your term or hers?
That's hers,
but you wholeheartedly agree.
It's good.
I mean, look.
Is it true, though?
Yeah.
Is he coddling the seaplane and summer house crowd?
Well, I actually think it's coddling his donors. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't tell who Andrew Cuomo is serving. It's not the people of the state of New York. So he's either serving his presidential ambitions or his donors. And that's what I see. Now, they're the seaplane owners, too. So it's the same category.
There's perfectly lovely people who own seaplanes and summer houses.
Yes, exactly. That's what I mean. Is I actually think... I think New Yorkers, this race and this moment in our history is about who we are as a people. And to your point, there are many wealthy New Yorkers who also want an economy that works for all of us and not just the wealthy and well-connected.
And want a fair tax situation, and they have no problem paying more because they believe in rich people paying more.
No, that's what I see. We have a deeply, deeply egalitarian state, and people who, you know, many, many, to your point, just to reiterate, wealthy New Yorkers who want a more fair tax policy. And that's why what I see instead is serving donors. Like Extel Corporation gave Andrew Cuomo a $100,000 campaign contribution. You have to understand that New York's campaign contribution laws are close to limitless. Right. $100,000 in a single contribution is extraordinary.
Yeah.
You know, at the federal level is $2,500. And within a week, they had gotten subsidies to develop a luxury building in downtown Manhattan. And this is at a time when the rent is too high. Property taxes are too high.
Right.
This is not the kind of subsidy that makes sense for the people of New York. It makes sense
when
for
it would
the
be
donors
built without the subsidy. I mean, that's the craziness.
Yeah.
Now, what is the carried interest loophole?
Oh, if you're going to get deep into tax policy, it's basically a way that certain financial industries avoid basic taxes.
Okay.
There's a series of ways in which the financial industry in New York avoids paying even the most basic corporate taxes that they should be paying. Mm-hmm. And Andrew Cuomo, instead of moving towards the way the country is moving, not in terms of policy, but most people say that banks should be fully prosecuted and taxed at fair levels. Mm-hmm. His narrative around the financial industry is if we don't give them everything they want, they're going to leave. And we know that's not true.
Right.
New Jersey at one point tried to
snatch it all away.
Yes, snatch it all away, giving subsidies to sort of most famously to Goldman Sachs to build a building. Well, they built the building. The building is still there, and you can't pay a trader to get there. So the deep lie at the base of Andrew Cuomo's economic policy is he looks at New York and he says, we aren't going to have any wealth in this state unless we beg a few oligarchs to move here or beg them to stay here. Mm-hmm. And that's just not true.
Right. Still the greatest city in the world.
So what about the raising the minimum wage?
Yeah, I think we got to raise it. I mean, Seattle, I think, has $15 an hour. That's something I think eventually we should be moving towards. The key, of course, is local wage authorization. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the key, is not having the state get in the way of municipalities figuring out what workers in their own cities need.
So in this state, municipalities can't set aside their own minimum wage?
Right. Yes.
Okay. So, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And so the local wage authorization fight was going on all spring. It's something Andrew Cuomo opposed. But I will tell you, I want to do more than just, I don't ever want to see a minimum wage become a maximum wage.
Mm-hmm.
Where we say, well, now we're finally there. Everybody's making $15 an hour. That's
right.
Enough. Because that actually is still a pretty barren vision of what an economy is.
Mm-hmm.
And the way I see it is one of the reasons that you have workers at such low wages with such few benefits is that we have more and more power concentrated in just a few companies. This is, again, what we mm-hmm. used to call the monopolies.
Right.
And then those companies have all the bargaining power and they can tell a worker, I'm not going to pay you anything. I'm not going to give you any benefits. You're only going to work part-time. Mm-hmm. You're going to work the hours I want. So I'm very inspired, as is my running mate, by Teddy Roosevelt and by FDR, two governors of New York, both of whom really saw the importance not just of union power, but also of antitrust.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll give you an example. I think it's the easiest example to get a hold of, but it's true throughout the economy. Right now, two big cable giants are set to merge, Time Warner and Comcast.
The two with the worst, but with the worst customer service ratings.
Terrible customer service ratings.
Right.
People pay over $100 a month for not great cable service. The Public Service Commission in New York is reviewing this merger. It's reviewing it under a public interest standard. In fact, New York is supposed to block this merger unless Comcast and Time Warner can prove that the merger is in the public interest.
Mm-hmm.
It's clearly not in the public interest.
Right.
So one, and I just submitted, along with my running mate Tim Wu, who invented the term net neutrality and has been a real leader in this, comments to the PSC. Saying we should block the merger.
That's the Public Service Commission.
Yes,
for
the public
people, and they control all utilities in the state.
But I think we should go farther than that. They are cable is bad service, expensive service, and terrible for workers. Because you try to negotiate as a worker, and there's only one game in town, you're going to get terrible benefits.
Mm-hmm.
So across the board, and by the way, I'll speak to you as media professionals. It's terrible for media.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I've mentioned Comcast and Time Warner merger on Time Warner and Comcast stations. But when they merge, it's going to be harder and harder. You don't hear about it very often. If you listen to MSNBC, you don't very often hear about the political nature of the Time Warner Comcast merger because
Comcast owns NBC.
Yes. And so that's a really serious political aspect to mergers, and that's what FDR and Teddy Roosevelt understood.
Right.
And starting in the early 80s, led by Reagan, but then unfortunately a lot of Democrats followed suit, we just forgot that we have this antitrust power. We stopped using it.
Mm-hmm.
We stopped looking for the levers in our laws or passing new laws that would enable us to do that. So we don't want to just take on big cable. We want to take on Amazon, which is right now crushing the publishing industry mm-hmm. in New York State. And picking winners and losers, and narrowing the number of publishers.
And the number of bookstores, for sure.
And the number of bookstores. Now, a governor who cared about this industry, this book publishing industry in New York, which is an extraordinarily important industry, would be looking for enforcing existing laws, but also passing new laws that gave us New Yorkers power against this Amazon encroachment.
Right.
It's a different way of thinking. It's a old-fashioned way of thinking, but unfortunately, I think it's been a missing piece in the, even the Democrats' analysis in the last 20 or 30 years.
So we're talking here about cable, and that's wonderful for the people who have cable. But in this county and in Greene County where we are, many people don't have any access to cable or broadband.
Yes.
Or anything like that. So what do you think about that, and how would you move to change that?
Look, I think, you know, as we know, access to affordable high-speed internet is essential for work. For people who need access to state services or federal services, that's essential. For people who are disconnected because of disabilities, mm-hmm. of whatever kind, it's essential. For
small
kids,
business,
for
farmers.
Oh, it's so critical to small business, mm-hmm. you know, and we have a vision of a small business economy. So, you know, I think that's just as a general public policy, affordable high-speed internet for everyone. Mm-hmm. Is one of the jobs of the state of New York. I'll tell you one of our visions. It relates to it because it's all about connectivity. You know, we believe in a connected New York. New York has one of the largest transportation economies in the world.
Right.
So we barely take care of it. Roads are in terrible shape. Bridges, yeah. You know, there's a few bridges that Andrew Cuomo spends a lot of energy on.
I can only think of one, but yeah.
But he tends to focus on symbolic transit moments as opposed to transit systems. Mm-hmm. And so we have a vision of New York State can be the center of 21st century transportation technology,
right.
The real center. And that means not just investing in the MTA, mm-hmm. which right now is $10 billion short of what it needs to be to even be safe and at functional levels.
Right.
But actually going a few steps further and saying, why don't we become the place where people come from all over the world if they want to? I don't know what it looks like in 2035 or 2030.
Mm-hmm.
But if we think about combining information technologies and transportation technologies to build a more connected New York, to connect upstate also in agro-tourism, mm-hmm. And value-add farming to downstate.
Right.
There's enormous opportunities there. And when I talk to high-tech investors, they get very excited about
and
the
need.
Idea. And need.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we let you go shortly because we have to get down to a campaign stop here at Basilica Hudson. Any last words or thoughts that we haven't really covered that you'd like to just get out there?
Yes, absolutely. This is a grassroots campaign. Andrew Cuomo has $35 million. In the last 3.5 weeks, actually, we just filed our fundraising report. He far outraised me. But he only got donations from 37 humans.
Wow.
And we got donations from over 900 people. Most of our donations were $15 or $50. His are closer to $60,000 to $120,000. So what I'd like to say is if this interests you, if you're listening and it interests you, our campaign can succeed because of you. And so go to our website at zephyrteachout.com or teachoutwoo.com and make your own lawn signs, organize your own town, be your own media, because this is a truly important moment for the future of New York.
Maybe you'll come back again during the campaign.
Well, we might get to because we come through this area a lot. Mm-hmm. So I'd love to try to do that.
Great. You know, one of the things just organizing this event, having you here and at the Basilica thing, the thing that I found most striking after dealing with many, many people and many, many different campaigns was that we did it really, we arranged it really quickly and everything stayed on track and no one said, oh, we have to change this or move that or that. It was like, it was straight on. So I want to say thank you for that because it was the whole time I was so nervous that something was going to go wrong. So thank you for it being just
well,
as easy
I am
as
really,
could be.
I have the best campaign team in the state.
That's
and
great.
I just couldn't be working with better people.
Listen, we are extremely proud that you took the opportunity to come and meet with us and to speak to our listeners. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. It's great to meet you.
It's wonderful to meet you.
Likewise. This is At Issue here on WGXC. We have been with Zephyr Teachout, who is the Democratic candidate for governor of New York State. We'll be back.